Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly. That was not my fault.
Did you have me muted?
No, I put it off, and then Ronan, the engineer, muted him.
We'll have to have a chat with you, Ronan. Oh, we love Ronan.
That was not me.
He always comes to the aid.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, if you didn't hear, I am Dr. Debra.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back.
So tell me about your weekend with Tiffany.
Oh, it's so special. She's such a sweetie pie. Oh, my God. I love that.
Tiffany is
so
Debra's daughter.
Oh, she's just an angel. Well, it was very, very, very special because part of the reason for going up there was she wanted to do one of her special treatments on me. So she does these bosties.
Uh-huh.
So they have a womb boss. She has a womb bosty and a heart bosty and some other things. It's a very wonderful process, and I thought I'll do the womb bosty because of my previous sexual abuse and violence and such. And
this is Ayurvedic medicine for those who, those of you who are right, like, what the hell is she talking about?
Right. So it was fascinating. So we got up there, so we just had spent all of Saturday together, and we went to her little studio, her little space. It's so pretty, it's so lovely, it's so soothing, it's so Tiffany. And so she gave me this beautiful relaxing massage, an Ayurvedic massage. It's very different than, let's say, a Swedish massage. It's very, very gentle. It's very, very soothing. Almost put me to sleep.
Wow.
And then she makes this thing. It's basically out of this almost like chickpeas and stuff, this paste kind of stuff. And it's this round thing that you attach to your lower belly.
Okay.
And then she keeps putting these medicines in.
Wow.
Across about an hour and a half time, where it's very warm.
Mm.
And then she does this meditation and listening to her voice, very soothing. And then you're sort of left to your own devices and your own mind about all these things. And I went all over the map from being 5 years old to being current to
past
traumas. And I mean, I was like a whirlwind of stuff. And then I was exhausted.
I bet.
I was just absolutely incredibly exhausted. It was very healing. It was very beautiful. I'm like, my girl rocks. Man.
She's amazing.
Just rocks.
Wow. That's incredible.
That was really nice. And the weather was very hot up there, but it was really lovely. We took some nice walks. I showed you the picture of the pond that we went to.
It's great.
It was lovely. Had some great food. They took us out for sushi dinner on Saturday night. And then we went to this, or Friday night. And then we went to this gorgeous brunch place on Sunday that was so stunning. And the second you walk out of the restaurant, you're in a forest.
Or oh my God.
Yeah.
And this is in Grass Valley?
This is in Nevada City, which is just above Grass Valley.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So it was lovely.
I love, you know, I'm like kind of part hippie. So when I hear about Tiffany, I'm like, that's the world that I kind of secretly want.
I got to tell you, but if anybody has like body image issues or like fear of like materialism, like sucking you in and all that stuff, just go up there. I mean, you don't see high heels. Women are walking around the streets without makeup.
Are you
it's
really?
Just really people talk to everybody. You know, you see somebody who's 70-year-old and a 25-year-old guy will just be chit-chatting about, you know, what's going on in town. And everybody just, it's like
love. I
need
to visit this.
It's just like community love. It's just amazing. I
love
it. Love
it.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's my next place of visitation is going to be that. Wow.
People have dirty feet because they want to walk on the earth more than they want to walk in shoes.
Love it.
It's great.
So cool.
How about you, honey pie?
So David and I took a little vacation in downtown LA in a hotel and did nothing. Like literally.
So funny.
I know. I swear to God, we got into the room. I napped immediately.
Okay.
And then
your regular babysitter, Susie.
Yep.
Yep.
Susie was there and we did nothing. We watched a movie. I ordered room service the next day. It was like so nice to just do nothing and
you
have quiet.
Literally,
did
nothing. You didn't go out to dinner.
Nothing.
No cocktail on the rooftop.
We didn't want to move. Like I think that's the funny part. It's like just so nice to just do nothing.
Which hotel?
It was Hotel Indigo.
Is
downtown.
It pretty?
It was beautiful.
Oh,
beautiful.
Nice.
It was great. I mean, we didn't enjoy any of the amenities, although I did go to the gym in the morning, but that was about
so
it.
Funny.
Isn't that funny?
So you get there on Saturday afternoon and you leave on Sunday morning?
Yes. And we just rest and sleep because I think that's like what our body is needing.
I know.
It's just doing nothing because we don't get that opportunity in our house.
Right.
So
I just saw Dog Days. You have to see it.
Remy's been asking me to
it
see
is
it. Really?
Adorable.
Maybe I'll see it this weekend.
And Christopher Robin is really cute, too.
Oh.
I'm one of those weirdos.
I know who goes to movies
kids
alone.
Movies and we don't have any kids. Oh my God. I swear I got to be a rent a grandma.
Well, I was just going to say, next time something comes out, let me know and we'll make it. And you go with us.
Okay. I would love that.
Because I would absolutely love that too.
Cool. Well, you know what London's going to want.
Popcorn.
I'm going to buy him all the food that he wants out of the concession.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be in big trouble. He's not going to hold back.
I will be his biggest. He'll be my biggest fan. Yeah, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So last week we had David Lay, a clinical psychologist, author of the book Insatiable Wives, who had a sort of the counterpoint of the common thinking about, you know, people, relationship experts actually encouraging people to have monogamous relationships and, you know, for death till you
do us part.
I can't speak.
Death till death do us part.
Right.
But you know what? I've been reading Insatiable Wives and I'm actually,
it's
really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was very impressed with him. And I think we both emailed him after. I thought he was a fantastic guest, very knowledgeable, knew about this. I really liked him. So I thought that was a really good show.
I always seriously respect people who are willing to put the counter perspective out there or something that's not what the standard thinking is about stuff. And backing it up, not just the people who are inflammatory, who goes, oh, that's a piece of shit. That's crazy stuff. This is what's really true. Well, based on what?
Well, that's what I'm saying. He had data.
He did.
Great.
Data. All right, I'm going to let you read because you're the one who can speak some French.
I'm going to try not to butcher it. So today, I'm so excited. We have Ariane Dubois-Vasson. I hope I said that
right.
That's
pretty good.
She is the author of Giggles and Joy, Spiritual Life Lessons for Kids. Ariane writes, coaches, and speaks frequently on issues of personal and professional change, happiness and inspiration, entrepreneurship, women in the workplace, parenting, and the topic of mindful living and conscious business. She has spoken at companies such as Google, Twitter, Morgan Stanley, Investec, the IDB, KPMG, and Seller, Nestle, and more. She has been a keynote at events including Oprah's Conference, Maria Shriver's Women's Conference, the Multi-Million Dollar Roundtable, and other international conferences. She's written articles for media outlets including Fast Company, Business Week, Oprah Magazine, Good Housekeeping, and more. She's also been written about in Forbes and USA Today.
Welcome.
Hi. Nice to be on. So excited.
So I have to start because I absolutely loved your books. And I have two boys, 9 and 5. And so it was such a, I have like the perfect demographic for you. And so I sat down with my kids and I read them probably about half of one of them. And I mean, they turned calm instantly. It was amazing. It was like your book was like the Adderall for children. It was calming and it was wonderful. And to be honest with you, my boys are not easy to calm. Deborah can vouch.
No, they're not.
But I think it was just, I don't know, it was the beautiful, the pictures and the words. It was so soothing. So I'm really, really impressed with what you did.
Thank you. That means the world to me. You know, I put these books in the world to help parents, help grandparents, godparents, anyone who has the privilege of raising our tiny humans, just to sort of give them a break. We're all exhausted. We're all trying to be great parents. We're all trying to do our best. And we're always being told what's not working or what we're not doing or what we're missing. And this was, you know, it's great to hear that it has that effect. And it really is also a calming effect for parents, which is, I know you want to raise kind children or kids that understand diversity or kids that are, you know, compassionate or, you know, value their body or whatever it is. And it's like, well, how do I do that? You know, like, really, how do I do that? And so the books were really a gift to the parents to make their role a little bit easier to just bring up, you know, beautiful, conscious kids.
And not to give away too much in the book, but I think it would be really special if you're okay with this. I want to just read the little part on kindness because it's actually short and sweet. And would you be okay
sure,
with that?
Of course.
Yeah, it's yes, just so user friendly. So Ariane writes, kindness is sharing your snack with someone who doesn't have one. Kindness is holding the door open for someone to let them in. Kindness is helping someone who is hurt. Kindness is thinking about other people's feelings. Kindness is sharing your umbrella when it's raining so no one has to get wet. Kindness is saying I'm sorry when you know you've hurt someone's feelings. Kindness is being gentle and loving to animals. Kindness is finding the perfect present for someone you love. Kindness is helping mom or dad clean up the kitchen after supper. Hear, hear to that.
I read that part, but that one I need to reread again.
Kindness is sharing your toys, even when you don't want to. Kindness is forgiving, letting go, and giving someone another chance. It's giving someone a hug and a kiss if you see they're feeling a bit sad. Kindness is noticing someone needs a bit of money and giving them a coin. Is listening and taking turns to speak. Kindness is inviting the new kid at school to play with you. Kindness is taking care of planet Earth and picking up any rubbish. It's so lovely.
It's beautiful.
And so true. Mm.
And you know what? I find like the illustrations, I have a wonderful illustrator that just really captured how a child would see this. So yes. The illustrations, you know, kids get very drawn into them. Some of them are hilariously funny. You know, you've got like elephants skiing with, you know, ice cream cones and a parachute. And just children love this. So while they're hearing and then being imprinted with a message that, you know, at some level they already know, and so much of it is just practice, it's just habit. And it's also, you know, parents being examples and role models of some of this too. Mm-hmm. And I love the kindness poem, you know. If I could have added something into the kindness poem, it's self-kindness. Because what I see more and more today is parents are very focused on raising kind children and kind humans. But then what happens is they forget that the most important kindness is what the child is saying to themselves about themselves.
Yes.
So when I catch my, you know, I have a four-year-old, when I catch him even slightly saying something that, you know, he's not good at something or he's this or he's that, like we do the cancel. And, you know, there's as much kindness towards himself as there is towards other people.
I love it. Great, great point for sure. Tell us, how did you come up with giggles and joy? Because they're two characters, actually, that you say are part of all of us.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the three books, the first one is Giggles and Joy, the second one, You're Loved, and the third is Being You. Like, I love observing humans, whether it's grown-ups or children. And noticing what's working, what's not, what's there, what's missing, what we'd all love more of. And my background and work in the last 10 years was a lot more sort of life skills for grown-ups. And giggles is not something you associate with grown-ups. And joy, not in the majority. And I thought, you know, why is it that that's sort of been beaten out of us, or it's just not as accessible, or we don't feel that, you know, it's what our natural state should be. And I thought, I started looking at like the impact on grown-ups, and then could you instill it at a much earlier age in children where it is their natural state and it needs to remain that, as opposed to be, you know, beaten out of them in some ways by more school, more performance, more academic, more achievement, more education. So giggles and joy for me were like the two things that if we could all have, and this is at any age, you know, it would make life easier. We would be able to flow with the bad days, with, you know, there's a poem in Giggles and Joy called Bye Bye Bad Day. And it's accepting it, but also having tools and life skills to be able to handle those things. You know, we never allow our kids to have a bad day. They're supposed to be happy. They can't be grumpy. They can't shout. They can't cry. They, you know, we get worried if they've had a bad day at school. Like, kids need to know that, totally get it. I had a bad day too. You know, here's what I do when I have a bad day. And to sort of, they will have a lot of bad days. Like, we have a lot of bad days as grown-ups. And having them be able to sort of wrap that up, keep what was good, keep what they want to remember from it, and then let it go. So, yeah, that's sort of where I was going with the first book, which is let's look at some life circumstances and let's give them some ways to handle them.
So I consider myself spiritual, and I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit, because I imagine you've gotten a little bit of controversy about like the spiritual nature of the books. And so maybe you can give us your rundown, kind of the difference between religion and spirituality.
Yeah. You know, so the tagline is spiritual life lessons for kids. And, you know, I thought long and hard about this. Do I take the word spiritual out? Do I leave it in? And I'm very big on intuition. I'm very big on, you know, teaching it to kids. We can talk about that later. But it was very clear to me that, you know, in raising humans, you think about mind, body, spirit. You know, nearly all religions talk about mind, body, spirit. They might talk about it differently. And we're very focused on the mind of our children. A lot of more of us are focused on their bodies and their health. And spirit is like, it's like not allowed to be talked about. And if you look at what I believe what's going on more and more in this country is we're much more in a spiritual crisis than anything else. And it starts with having a conversation about, you know, what is the spirit of someone? What is, you know, what brings the joy back? What brings the hope and the optimism back in kids, teenagers, and adults that are depressed? It's a reviving of their spirit mm-hmm. more than anything. It's reviving of why they're here. It's understanding, you know, why bad things have happened. It's sort of, you know, bringing optimism and bringing hope. So to me, I you know, I've had a lot of people ask me what that means. And I can say, and I've had lots of parents, schools I've been invited to of all religions who have really said, you know, this stands right beside all the spiritual religious texts. This is more of an understanding about what makes us all universal, all human, where any child of any culture, any nature, any religion, you would be, you know, in alignment with what this shares. This is more Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of a lifting up of the child in all ways, as opposed to telling the child what to believe or what to think.
Mm, gotcha. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Did you write all of these up one after the other, or did you take a break in between them?
That's a funny question. You know, some of them, well, you know, part of the inspiration was my own son who didn't sleep for 18 months. And so as spiritual as I was like, what have I done? You know, why is this child not this perfect angelic Buddha baby, which is the pregnancy that I had. And, you know, a lot of us have these ideas for our kids, whether they're going to be this or that. I honestly thought my child would be very calm and sleep. And for whatever reason, that wasn't his path, at least not for then. And so I really had to stretch myself into finding things to say, mm. finding, you know, ways to be with him, finding music that was outside necessarily of my natural way of how I would have parented. And I started saying some of these phrases, poems, you know, whatever you want to call them, to help him and to nurture him. So, you know, one of the first poems that I wrote was "You Are Safe." Because I think for, you know, these little beings, whatever your spiritual path, to come into a physical body, to be born into a world, to meet, you know, one or two parents, it sort of creates a level of, you know, please tell me I'm loved and safe and protected and guided. And so that was one of the very first poems that I started telling my son. There's nothing to fear. All fear is an illusion. Nothing and no one can hurt you. There's nothing for you to be, nothing for you to do, nothing for you to change. You're already perfect. You're wanted. You're worthy. You know, you're unique. Thank you for being our child. Thank you for, you know, those words just came through me, and they were so helpful. And even when he was two or three, he'd be like, Mom, can you tell me a poem? Or Mom, can you tell me the moon loves you, or that, which is another poem. And I started writing them down. I thought, you know what? These are really sweet and special. Like, I didn't think I'd be on your show. I didn't think I'd write a book. But life has other ways. You know, I think so much of what I do is to create, you know, happier, easier lives. And I do hear parents struggle, whether it's just with sleep. If you mm-hmm. just want a calm book to put your kids to sleep, you know, regardless of life skills,
sure.
this will have that effect, because I certainly see it, and I've seen it with friends of mine who've used it for that purpose. But they, you know, I would say it took me about 6 months to transcribe all the ones that I was already saying. And then I started listening and observing and witnessing other parents who were like, I really need, you know, I need something on telling the truth. Mm-hmm. I need something on gratitude. I need something on change, because our family's gone through so much change. And then I would sort of, I'd sit and I'd meditate and I'd kind of let it come through me. And then I found, you know, a friend of mine who helped me make some of them rhyme, and then an illustrator. And it really felt like the universe was very supportive to the project. And they're very unique books. I don't think that, you know, mm-hmm. they're not in the majority. They're not in, you know, they're not a story, but yet I'd say every life skill is a story. And, you know, there are 8 skills in every book, so 24 skills each. I tell a lot of parents, you know, just pick one. Have it be the theme for the week. Mm-hmm. Have, you know, have the theme of, whatever it is, courage, be the theme of the week. And then everyone in the family gets to see and acknowledge and remind and be with that, or telling the truth. This week is the truth week. And it allows a conversation and sort of an entry point. Like, of course, parents want their kids to tell the truth, but like, how do you do it? How are you not encouraging your child to tell the truth?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I wanted to be a little bit of assistance.
So we are talking with Ariane de Bonvoisin.
I hope I'm saying it right. Very good.
And she is the author of Giggles and Joy, the series, Spiritual Life Lessons for Kids. I love that, because that is such a great idea to pick one for the week.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of
and
talk
have the
about,
whole family participate.
That's what I'm
that's
thinking.
Really amazing.
Oh my God, I love that. Because I didn't think about that. I was just kind of reading as you go through, but I love that idea.
It would be kind of...
You know, I find also having the child, depending on their age, sort of naturally gravitate towards the one they want. Mm-hmm. And it's usually the one they most need to be with and hear. You know, that's another entryway I tell, you know, teachers have used it, parents have used it, even just to understand more of the inner life of their child. You know, we all want to know what's really going on with our child beyond just, you know, how was your day at school and was your friend kind to you? Like, what are they really feeling deep down? Like, what are they dreaming about? And, you know, there's a poem in here called Sad and Mad, mm-hmm. and it allows kids to be sad and to be mad. And even just sort of going, you know, what made you sad today? Or what's something that really, really made you sad? And you'll be amazed. You know, my son told me he was really sad that he saw a tree that had been cut down in Central Park, and he wanted to cry and he wanted to kiss the tree. Like, that's such beautiful information for me to know,
right?
That seeing that tree being cut down really made him very sad. I would never have known that if I hadn't asked or if I hadn't read the poem. Or, you know, what made you really mad or angry? And you just get to know your children at this intimacy level that they don't have the language for unless you actually have the question.
Right, right. And also, to your point before about the family part of it, it's always, I've found it so helpful for children when they see their parents communicating in this way too, right? When the parent can say, oh, you know, I was sad today when I saw this, or I was mad when I saw this, obviously mm-hmm. keeping it developmentally appropriate for sure. your child, mm-hmm. but that's so wonderful. You know, you encourage your children to express their feelings and such, but if they see their parents never doing the same, then they're not as likely to jump on board. So it's lovely.
I'm very big on this, which is sort of the need for parents to feel like they have these skills. And, you know, I'm putting together an online course, which is actually for parents, for them to know not only how to teach these life skills, but also just how to be them and live them, because they are the role models. They are the people that, you know, our mm-hmm. kids are looking up to us. You know, my kid very often, you know, he hurt himself the other day and he asked my husband, mm-hmm. his father, he said, Daddy, did you also get a lot of knocks and bruises and stitches when you were my age? And it was just so important for him to know that, you know, this was part of the path and this was normal. And, you know, allowing them to have a conversation about, you know, what is not what is human, but what is part of their path, it allows them to feel like they can be human and they're not different or weird or clumsy or not good enough. Or there's a such important message to get across to kids.
Absolutely. I'm really curious if you can speak to, I'm sure that some parents out there are saying, oh, this is all beautiful and wonderful, but what if my kid misbehaves? What the hell do I do then? You know, do I practice time out? Do I pull out one of these poems and while he's, you know, tearing my hair out or tearing his brother's hair out? You know, just maybe you could, because you have such a beautiful essence to you. I wonder what your philosophy is or your style is in terms of helping children with structure and boundaries, et cetera.
Yeah, no, parenting's very messy. You know, I had a tough moment last night with my child. Like, in some ways, I think he was preparing me for your chat and you know, the question. you know, we have lots of, I have lots of tools. So it's not sort of a one, here's what happens, I go to this. There's a couple of things. One, when something is going on with my child, my very first immediate question that I do with myself is, what's going on with me? I had a shitty email. I missed a meeting. I've got too much work. I had an argument with my husband. I didn't get to the gym. My mom annoyed me. Like, I immediately go into self-responsibility. Uh-huh. And when I can clear that, I'm not going to take that out on my child.
Good.
Right? So I have 3 more hours of work. My child's misbehaving. Your response to your child will be a lot more if you're unconscious to why you are feeling unsettled. So the most important thing is for me to immediately clear my state. So what's here for me? Why am I so upset that he ripped through all his toys and his room's a mess? Why am I so annoyed that he's not eating his dinner? When neither one of those things are really not a very big deal if you just look at them as facts. Mm-hmm. So I clear my own self so that I can be in a state that is sort of somewhat calm and composed, hopefully. And then I usually stop the behavior, whether, you know, it's a physical behavior or verbal behavior, by being with my child. I don't send them away. I don't get them to go anywhere. The first probably tool I use is breathing. Mm-hmm. Because when your child's misbehaving, they're not breathing. Their brain has gone spizzy, as we call it here at home. They are not in a place where they can talk or they can explain why they're in a bad mood or they can explain why they're misbehaving. So a lot of parents go into the mental, why is he doing this? Why is she hitting his sister, her sister? Like the why. Kids cannot go into the mental when their mind and their brain has kind of disengaged.
Yep.
So you have to go into the emotional or the physical, right? The physical is touch, hold, contain, boundaries. Mm-hmm. Physical is also breathing. Mm-hmm. So we sit down, we take 3 deep breaths, we're going to take some breaths, we're going to give your brain some oxygen, we're going to breathe like a dinosaur today. You know, and this is obviously for younger kids. We're going to, you know, so what animal are we going to pick? We're going to do this. But I get some of the movement of the breath going again. I certainly will put limits. I certainly will, you know, I am very quick to go, I won't let you do this. This is not allowed in this household. That's not what you do. But what I see parents do is there's a lot of bargaining, negotiation, trying to understand, trying to have a conversation. Right. There's no words. Words are not what works when you're going into discipline. Actions mm-hmm. are what works.
Yeah, because otherwise it just frustrates the parent so much, and then the child is picking up on that anxiety as well, and now you got a vicious cycle.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Back and forth.
The other thing I would say, too, is that, the child, I practice, you know, what I would call more respectful parenting, which is even though my child is 4, I hold him accountable to the fact that he knows when, you know, something is right or wrong, whether he hit someone, hurt someone, whatever has happened. And I think when you engage a little bit more from a sort of respectful place, as opposed to I'm the parent, I'm telling you, you did this. Mm-hmm. Children rebel. They push back. It gets them even more upset in some ways.
Sure.
I do, you know, a new thing I do is if my child does want to go to his room, you know, we leave the door open. The door is not closed because there's not a shut off. And I say, come on out here. I'm ready to talk when you are. If you want a hug, let me know. If you just want to take your time. But allowing them to sort of find a way to get through it as opposed to me having to fix it.
Mm.
Again, you're giving them the tools to manage their emotions. Mm-hmm. You are not managing their emotions.
This is so important.
I have to share a little story over the weekend. You heard the introduction, Ariane, about visiting my daughter. She's an Ayurvedic practitioner up in Nevada City. And so while I was waiting for her to clean up so we go off and do our other spiritual exciting things that day, I was in the waiting room and there was a spirituality magazine and there was an article written by Gandhi's grandson.
Mm.
And this was fascinating. So according to the grandson, his own dad was disciplined by Gandhi in the most unusual way. But I loved what you said, Ariane, about respect. So their household was built on love and respect. But when a child misbehaved, the parent held the parent responsible to the level that they were the ones who got the punishment. And the punishment was to not eat. So if there was a small infraction, the parent would not eat because they would believe that if my child believes it's okay to behave this way, I haven't done my job.
Mm.
It's really interesting.
Wow.
And then if it was a major infraction, wouldn't eat for the whole day. And what, according to this tale, if it's true or not, is that the child really developed a sense of conscience because it wasn't like, okay, well, I'm getting punished for 5 minutes and then I can go back and do the same thing I'm doing. It was like, oh no, my parent is actually suffering as a result of my behavior and really learning consequences.
I'd be anorexic. You know, I would be like, I'd be 3 pounds if I took that into account.
Well, you'd be, I know. Poor Kelly.
I'm not kidding. I wouldn't eat for like months on end.
But it was fascinating, right? I mean, yes. It was so counterintuitive to what many people
You know what
do.
I love about that, too? It makes me think of, it's, you know, we don't want to raise our kids to be like me, 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 me people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you get them early on to realize the interdependence of their actions, their impact on the family, if mm-hmm. they do something or don't do something, other people are affected. You know, and you can explain it. I've explained this to my son where I go, you know, if this man doesn't go to work today in the restaurant, like the customers will not get their meals. Like mm-hmm. that's the impact of him making a good choice and a decision.
Right.
You know, he's been to a restaurant. He knows what that means. So having them understand that everyone and everything is connected mm-hmm. is a very, very important life skill to get very, very soon.
So I'm curious your thoughts about, I imagine you have plenty, about our education system for kids and basically, you know, how would you educate our kids differently?
Yeah, I have lots of that. I just did a TED Talk exactly on this subject, which will be out in a couple of months.
Oh, cool.
You know, I'm of course informed by the way I was first educated. I went to 6 schools, 3 continents. I, you know, am obviously raising one child. I've got godchildren. I've sort of looked at what's there, what's not there. And I was brought up very much where I was educated above the neck. So it was my mind. It was about performance, achievement, comparison, grades, the safe route, do what's expected of you, make your parents happy. And unfortunately, that is still, you know, I'm in my early 40s now, that is still very much what I feel, not only the education system is providing our children, but what parents are expecting from their children. You know, right. I don't meet a lot of parents who'd be okay with their kids, you know, doing not particularly well at school or not going to college. My gosh, what a concept. You say that to people and they're horrified at the thought, even though it's very likely that in 20 years, our college system might look very different than it is today. So my big belief, my big sort of, you know, phrase that I'm using for myself and others these days is we must start educating and focusing on developing our kids below the neck, which means valuing their body, valuing their emotions, building up their heart and their spirit, teaching them things like intuition, which I have to tell you, most parents have never mentioned the word to their kids. You know, mm-hmm. some conscious parents might have, but it's not done early on. You know, here in our family, intuition is like big. If someone's lost a toy or a pair of glasses, it's, you know, what does your intuition tell you? Not, you know, in anything sort of more mental, where there's a trusting of self, not a trusting of my brain, not a trusting of the fact that I, you know, got the right best score in my spelling test, but there's a trusting of self so that when some of that stuff goes away, mm-hmm. there's still an inner me that has answers, you know, that, right. that has been brought up and educated in a way that I can still rely on myself, because there's so much change that's going to come in a child's life that I really believe that, you know, just telling them that their mind matters is very risky, you know, because there's a lot of brilliant, amazing minds out there, and mm-hmm. their brilliant mind is not going to get them the career that they love. That right. they're not going to get right. that from their mind. They're going to get it from their passion, from their heart, from their hobbies, from permission to actually mm-hmm. feel it and know it and acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
They are not going to find their beloved through their mind. They're not going to, you know, necessarily find how they want to contribute to the world through their mind. That's below the neck stuff. And that right. creates fulfillment. That fills up empty people. And I've done so much coaching with grown-ups who are very empty below the neck. There are some of those brilliant minds, CEOs, you know, you name it. But the emptiness is that what the other parts of them were never valued. And so they never got A's for them. They were never told that they mattered. That's where I'd like to sort of add to our education. I don't think it needs to, you know, radically change. I think it needs to be an addition mm-hmm. of, you know, there needs to be teaching on self-love, self-kindness, self-compassion, self-knowledge, you know?
Mm-hmm.
self-everything. Not because you know, the self is what's important, just because that is who your child will be with for the rest of their life.
Absolutely.
Not their parents, not their teacher, not their first girlfriend. They will be with themselves. And the level of self-abuse and self-criticism and self-doubt and self, you know, negativity is so high within children, teenagers and the grown-ups that I've been around, including myself, that is what I would like to sort of add a little bit of sort of balm to, where it doesn't have to be that bad. Like, why, where does it go? Where, why does it start? You know?
Yeah, Kelly and I deal with that issue in private practice all the time, having clients who have no idea how to self-care, to self-love, to have self-kindness, and yet they're doing everything all the time for other people, burning themselves out. But just, you say, can you do exactly what you're doing to them, but look in the mirror and put that back on yourself? And they're like, what do you mean?
Yeah,
I don't
like
even know how to start.
Yeah.
Well, no, doing just just role, whatever you're doing to someone else, role model that and do it to yourself. But it's such a challenge, because I think a lot of our culture also gets people afraid that if they do that, that they're arrogant,
selfish,
or they are selfish, all that. And so it makes it a challenge. How do I not make that all or nothing? How do I have a healthy version of that where I don't become the obnoxious, arrogant narcissist?
I've had to learn it myself as a parent. You know, I'll pack an entire day of lunches and snacks and water bottles and spare clothes and raincoats for my son, and I'll walk out the door without a water bottle and without one snack for me.
So
like, I've done it. I've done it a million times, and now I have literally asked my son to remind me, "Mommy, do you have snacks?" Or mom, like, because we all do that.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you know, we'll forget our hoodie, but, you know, our son will have two extra sets of clothes. And
so true.
Or, you know, I'll pack a ton of things for the airplane for him, and then I'll forget. I won't even have a book in my backpack.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I'm just, and it's not a guilt thing. It's just a sort of putting ourselves on the map and sort of existing. And I can tell you, we'll raise much healthier children when they see that, you know, right now mom's in the bus. Or I can't play with you, or I need grown-up time, or I'm going to go speak to a girlfriend, because then it gives them permission to also go do things
same.
That they want to do.
Right.
You know, they're not going to be raised doing things, you know, that are not in line with things that are important to them. But I still struggle with it, and I'm more than aware of, you know, where is my existence? Where do I live? And when I'm run down, I'm not a good parent. I overreact. Things are a bigger deal. So the truth is, better parenting really does start with what's going on with you.
Right.
What are you not doing for you?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Wow. Well, I love so much of what you've touched upon, because I totally agree. And even, you know, when we started this interview, when you were talking about how you imagine your child to be a certain way. And I think that's so huge. And I'm so glad you spoke to that, because I too was the same thing. You kind of imagine your kids to be a certain way, and then when they're not, you're like, wait, what is going on here? And you really have to kind of dig deep and just accept who they are, you know, wholeheartedly. So yeah, I think that is a struggle and something we don't really talk about, I think, in our society too much.
No. And you know, the projections on your child, they start the minute you even know you're pregnant.
Of course.
Like, you know, especially if you know what the gender is going to be, you not only have your own projections of what it means to have a boy or a girl, you have your tribe, which is your religion, or, you know, the environment you brought in, your family's perception of a boy or a girl, you have the culture's perception of a boy or a girl, you have sports teams' perceptions of boy, like, you have all of that is already imprinted in your child before they're even born, right? It is an enormous pressure on this physical body that happens to be a boy or a girl, right?
Right.
That is what they're starting off with. Like, we talk about all the chemicals that are being found in babies when they're born. I love saying, do you know the pressure and impact and heaviness that is already on your child before they've even, you know, taken a breath? And to sort of lighten that up. And the only way to do that is for the grown-ups and the adults to do some of that letting go work, which is, you know, looking at some really strongly held beliefs about what you want your child to be or do, what you think boys should do, what you think girls should do. You know, my husband's from South Africa. In South Africa, boys play rugby. You know, I have a boy. Like, okay, does that mean he must play rugby? No, of course not. And yet that's like religion in South Africa, you know, like all boys play rugby. But I use it as a sort of funny analogy, but we have dozens of the rugby analogies that are being put on our children. And it's not fair on them. It's too heavy. Mm-hmm. It's sticky. It's like, it's not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
When I was pregnant, it was fascinating because I was one of the very rare people who actually did not want to know the gender of my child during pregnancy. I thought this would be really cool to just be surprised because I, you know, as long as my baby is healthy, I'm going to be the happiest person on the planet. What I found fascinating, though, was that everybody around me was projecting what they thought I was, because I carried, I guess, what's stereotypically more like a boy. Straight out front, like a basketball. And so people go, oh, you're having a boy. So what are you going to do with your boy? And all the stuff that, I don't know that I'm having a boy. I don't know that I'm having a girl. But whatever I'm having is going to be just fine.
Exactly.
And she or he is going to determine who they're going to be.
Exactly.
But it was so much pressure from my inner circle of people. Like, well, are you going to decorate it this way? If it's, and like, I don't really know.
Right.
It's interesting.
Yeah. I had the same, you know, I didn't know if it was boy or girl. And to the point where my child was born, and it took 15 minutes for me to turn to my husband and go, what do we have?
Oh.
It was so unimportant. And my husband was like, what do you mean? And he sort of had to unwrap, you know, and had to kind of peer in.
Oh, you didn't? Like, he didn't know either.
Yeah. It was so really unimportant. Funny. You know, it wasn't the classic Hollywood, you know,
right.
It's a boy,
right.
It's a girl. That didn't happen for us.
Well, it's so funny because I didn't find out.
The truth is, I had to do, even though I didn't go through my pregnancy, you know, I worked with my coach, spiritual coach, on my fears around having a boy and my fears around having a girl and my preferences about having a boy and my preferences about having a girl. And I wanted to be, to at least have made some dent or some progress in that so that it wasn't something my child was going to carry or that I was going to have to solve or go through while, you know, he was growing up. And that stuff is not easy.
No, that's beautiful. Kelly, you were going to say
I was
going to
say, I did not find out with Remy.
Uh-huh.
And I could have sworn, I knew that if a girl came out of me, I was going to return him to the doctor and say, no, this is not my child. I knew it was a boy. I knew, like a gut feeling. And Remy jokes with me about it today. He's like, what would have happened if I was a girl, Mom? I'm like, nope, you wouldn't have been coming home with me.
Did you know for London?
That's so funny.
We did find out for London.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we knew for that. But it was cool not knowing.
Yeah.
But people got really mad.
Right.
Like, when I would tell them,
know?
Yes, exactly. Like, are you kidding me? What do you mean you don't know?
Right.
I'm calling your doctor. I'm going to find out.
And a lot of people have told me, too, that they didn't want to know. And their doctor just tells them the second they have that ultrasound, they can see it because they just assume everybody wants to know. And they just blurt it out.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not right. But it happens.
We didn't even have a name for him for 28 days.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's how, yeah, we you know, we were just, we wanted to be with the child because that's also something we impose on our child, like, you know, family name or tradition name or religious name. And I say that very respectfully. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be with my child for at least a few days or a week and just kind of feel in, look in his or her eyes and go, is this your name? Did it, you know? Mm. They also got to participate and choose.
Love it.
It's so sweet. We've been talking with Ariane de Bonvoisin. I love it.
I'm
going to
take
name.
A stab at it. Wait.
Go,
Ariane
go for it.
De Bonvoisin.
That's very good. Yeah.
They're getting better and better. I'm very impressed.
And she is the author of the Giggles and Joys Spiritual Life Lessons for Kids series.
So do you have a favorite of your books? Is there one book or one poem that is your actual absolute favorite?
You know, it changes because I also love change. I would say the Being You poem is very close to my heart. And the Being You poem is really about love not being conditional on being a girl or a boy or performance or grades or positions. And, you know, there's more to life than positions and grades. As time goes by, they're important to say. You're loved by your parents, however you score. Don't think that high marks make them love you more. Mm-hmm. You're loved not for what you do. It's who you are that's the best part of you. Doing your best is what matters the most. And please don't look at your friends to compare or to boast. You know, this is a much longer poem, but, you know, kids think being clever is the best thing to be. We think looking pretty is the best thing to see. We want to be fast, be strong, and jump high. But are these really the best goals to live our lives by? This is the poem I needed as a child.
Me too.
And I didn't get it. And it informed, and I say that from a quite emotional place. This is the poem I needed to survive at home in an environment that was very tough, you know, on the intellectual education side, where that's what mattered and that's what got, you know, a hug from my dad or any form of attention. And it took me many years and decades to kind of allow myself to drop the perfection and drop the performance and drop the comparison and drop the competition. And it is urgent for parents to not put those things on their child, because, you know, it's a heavy, heavy burden to put on them, and that they are allowed to exist with the mistakes and with the tantrums and with the misbehaviors, and that love is not taken away. You know, I mean, I said it to my son last night, I love you. You've said some bad things to me tonight, and I love you no matter what. Like, it's just a reinforcement of it. You know, giving them permission to be what they want. You know, when you start thinking about what you want to be when you're older and bigger, maybe 23, a fireman, a teacher, a musician, or a vet, maybe you can't even decide yet. You know, whatever you choose to do with your life, remember, it's yours to do as you like. People might say, that's not what to do. But you will know if it's the right thing for you. You know, I needed to hear that as a child.
Sure.
That's why this is my favorite.
I'm even going to challenge the parents who are listening right now, or parents-to-be or grandparents, that, you know, one of the things you often hear from parents is, well, I had the best of intentions, or I meant well, almost like a defensive, like, oh, I needed to do that because I had the best of intentions. But maybe challenging ourselves as parents, as aunts, uncles, grandparents, that maybe our intentions aren't good enough. I mean, they're wonderful, but that we actually take actions that demonstrate something that is more in line with these things that we're talking about today.
I would add to that, which is to ask parents to do a tiny bit of the inner work of, you know, well, what is most important in me raising this child now? Because, you know, I've spoken to hundreds of parents all around the world, all different cultures. And you can imagine 95% of them say, I just want my kids to be happy. And
yes,
if I have their permission and I can coach and I can dig a little bit, you know, I go, no, you don't. I go, let's look at actually how you're parenting and what is most important in your household and whatever. What are you doing to create a happy child? They're creating an educated child, a musical child, an athletic child, in many ways a perfect child who's a good boy and a good girl who's fitting in, right? That is, like, you can tell, like, your life is a representation of what's most important to you, a healthy child. But a lot of the times you hope that all of that is the byproduct of happiness. And yet happiness actually needs to be put on, what am I doing to actually create happiness? And I say this, and it's challenging for parents, but all the research shows that the most important thing a child needs to be happy is for their parents to be happy.
Wow.
Not together, for each parent to be happy. And so when I coach parents with whatever's going on with their kid, I look at mom and I go, how happy is mom? I look at dad, I go, how happy is dad? I don't look at the couple, it's not what I do. But you know what the answer is. Usually mom's not happy and dad's not happy. They might be fine together. But happy child is first, like, how happy am I? What's going on with me? What am I not doing? Right? Which, again, goes back to the self-care. You want happy children? How happy are you?
Ariane, you have been absolutely amazing, but you're not going to leave it. We have to wrap up. So tell us really quickly, I want to look out for this TED Talk. So when does this come out, first and foremost?
They don't tell you. All I've been told is it's going to be probably around October.
Okay.
It's on three life skills we must be teaching our kids.
Love that.
And it's, you know, I'll obviously promote it. It'll be on my website.
Beautiful.
Just Ariane Studio, A-R-I-A-N-E studio.com. So, yeah, that'll be there. And then obviously Giggles of Joy has its own website. I'll put it up on there too, because it's so obviously in line with the book series.
You're
Thank
such
you
a
so
joy,
much.
And I love what you're doing. And I mean, really, like I said, you calmed my kids. So in my book, you're my hero. So thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
So much.
Thanks for all the beautiful questions. It's nice to go on the journey with you for a little hour.
Oh, aww. Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, wow. I just feel so good inside now,
She's
right?
She's such,
so, such a sweetie.
Gem.
Okay. Next week, Merrily McLean, best-selling author of Prosecuted But Not Silenced, courtroom reform for sexually abused children. Wow. That'll be an
interesting and heavy topic. Yeah, exactly.
One.
Heavy
okay.
topic.
Anyway, have a beautiful week. Thank you so much for listening.
Follow us on Instagram at Two Shrinks and Facebook, The Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show. Talk to you guys next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.